This is the call of the Kauai o'o bird, which is now extinct. We're opening today's episode of the Interspecies Podcast with this, an extract from Reanimated, an artwork by Jakob Kutsk-Steensen. Jakob is one of our guests on today's episode, and you can hear more about this work later in the episode.
Painting a picture of an extinct bird that I have observed in nature, putting it in the proper habitat, exactly where it lived, is my way of bringing it back to life to some extent.
Welcome to the Interspecies Future podcast. Interspecies Future is an initiative by Berlin-based art foundation LAS, marking the beginning of a multi-decade civilizational journey in advancing the new rights and opportunities for non-human life on Earth, as made possible by the emergence of planetary-scale computing. This is episode 6, where we're talking about the relationship between literature, artistic narratives, and the interspecies.
As a science fiction writer, I always think, there are many narratives about like interspecies communication, but sometimes I also feel there's so many limitations in the text because we have to put it down into languages, like specific languages. It's linear.
You're suddenly confronted with a perspective of reality that's different than the one you're used to considering as kind of stable or harmonic. You know, if we want to become interspecies, most of those perspectives are going to seem dystopian. By the nature of the modernist perspective, is not interspecies. So it is shattering your reality, and you have to enter a new one.
Actually, story is re-enchanting the world.
Our guests today were science fiction writer Stanley Chu-Fan Chen and immersive artist Jakob Steensen. In this episode, we ask, what do we learn from stories about non-human life? And how might those stories change with the introduction of new technology and science? In this conversation, we talked about both the limits and possibilities of human language as a means to understand other species, as well as the capacity of science fiction to imagine new futures. Jakob and Stan, thanks for coming on the podcast. Could you both introduce yourselves, please?
So my name is Jakob. I'm an artist from Denmark. I live in Berlin. I used to be in New York up until 2 years ago, but then moved to Europe to work on two specific projects that are dealing with wetlands. So common for all my works is that I work with very kind of diverse forms of collaborators, from music to poets, science fiction writers, but also natural history museums and field biologists, as well as game developers. So I build little collaborative teams from different fields, and then I bring them into landscapes, often for months at a time. And then over time, that evolves into these increasingly kind of orchestral forms of collaboration that turns into they are immersive installations, but also we made a book last summer with different collaborators writing about lost mythologies and language and wetlands, as well as virtual reality or video games or AR. So it's quite a broad range of what the work becomes. But through this kind of excursion, some kind of new narrative or perspective or sensibility or imagination of our relationship to this specific location arises, something that I cannot predict before I start a project. But to the source of it, is looking at overlooked or forgotten perspectives on natural environments. So I've gone from working more with, for example, I did a project with the Rainforest Alliance about kapok trees like 6 or 7 years ago. And for that one, I was interviewing researchers on their sensibility, their memory of different layers in the canopy. And then I've also worked with sinking tropical islands, vanishing glaciers. So these kind of more, let's say, the conventional, iconic narratives of climate change. But now I've gone towards looking at things that people have forgotten about. So that is like these wetlands, the energies, the water, the soil that's right in front of us and beneath everybody's feet, and kind of bring a sense of magic sensibility to what I like to think of as like a fairly broad audience that shows at both museums and festivals and online. So that's how I would describe my practice in short.
Stanley Chufan Chen, I'm a Chinese speculative author. So I have two books in English. One is Waste Tide, talking about electronic waste issue in the near future China. So the latest book is called AI 2041, 10 Visions for Our Future. It's a collaboration with Dr. Kai-Fu Lee. So talking about how AI as a technology gonna change our society and individual in the next 20 years. So it's happening all around the world in 10 different countries, 10 different cities. So tapping different industry and issues such as like climate change, also aging society, et cetera, et cetera. So personally, I'm also working with a musician and artist. Like we co-create some NFT last year. And I just work with a electronic band called Frankfurt Helmet. It's a Chinese band. So they released a new album and I generate some imageries and also fresh science fiction with each songs. And of course, there's one short story I want to mention is like just published in the anthology Anthropocene Life. It's called Do You Hear the Fungi Sing? So it's actually talking about the fungi network and the conflict with our like a cybernetic network and how we can imagine the combination of the two in the near future. So this is something interests me in recent years. I spend a lot of time visiting all of those indigenous people and minority village, try to understand how their narrative to create this kind of belief and daily practice interacting with other species. So I think, yeah, this is totally fascinating.
And on that, because you were speaking there about interspecies communication and exploring that theme through this short story, what capacity do you think art and literature has to develop or interrogate that, those ideas of interspecies communication and relationships?
Yeah, like when we think of like interspecies communication, we'll always think about like the communication with animals, like dogs, cats, horse, and like in Planet of the Apes series, we actually considering animal as like they're intellectually below human. So they have to enhance their intelligence, then we can speak to them, which is to me is totally wrong. So because I think that definitely so many different ways of communication, maybe it's linguistic, but maybe it's beyond the language. And for example, the microbe within our physical body is actually changing our thoughts, our behavior, our habits every nanosecond. But we just don't consider it as a way of communication, but it's happening for so many years, maybe in a more profound way. So I think as a science fiction writer, I always think, yeah, there are many narratives about like interspecies communication, but sometimes I also feel there's so many limitations in the text because we have to put it down into languages, like specific languages. It's linear, it's a limitation, but there's so many things like beyond that. Like I have several stories actually talking about it. One is called Endless Farewell. It's talking about how human consciousness embedded to a alien species. So it's not using language, it's actually haptic and bodily sensory communication. So actually there's no any language, but all he can do is like to use this kind of metaphorical expression of how we touch with our physical body, with the environment. So that kind of sense forming the whole system of language. So it's so difficult to express and to deliver all this kind of message to the audience, right? So I think we definitely need a lot of different cross-medium forms like AR, VR, music, and I don't know what else could be invented in the future, but I think from literature to more multi-sensory, immersive medium arts, so we have to work together to build up a new kind of communication across different species.
For me, what I've been, like my approach has been to think about rhythm. So instead of thinking about like one language to explain the world, you know, like we kind of have a scientific paradigm right now that looks to kind of objectify and categorize each element. And then you go deeper and deeper and deeper and you look for a continuous like how and why all the time in this like almost infinite scale, because like the universe has an infinite scale. So you just keep going. But things connect to each other. You know, all the different life forms, are like Stanley was saying with bacteria in your gut influence how you feel emotionally. This is kind of like a rhythm that's always moving and it's constantly there through your life. But we kind of, when we only create like narratives that has a specific beginning and an end, we tend to create this more like linear trajectory of saying my relationship to the microbes in my stomach and the air in the room I breathe and these plants are with it. Like these are kind of connected in this like linear scale because that's how we build our language and science. But when you think about rhythm, rhythm today could be so much more. Because just like you have, you know, traditional music, Western music also has this narrative, but sound and rhythm in on its own can connect across multiple scales at the same time. So for me, that has been a unifier of connecting different elements. So that I can like take, I can record soil. I work with a collaborator. One I work with a lot is Matt McCorkle. And he can like record the soil. We can take these recordings of the soil, send vibrations through that, that maybe you can't hear in space, but it feels like inside of your body, then those vibrations can also influence someone else in a work, like a virtual texture or a leaf. And then you can start programming different variables and start having a life on its own. And things slowly start like evolving into some kind of pulsating organism that makes you like feel like what it's like, how, you know, narratives that otherwise are quite abstract to us becomes more rhythmic and sensory. So that's why I've been like striving towards building almost like instruments. And that's something I've done for 6 years. And with LAS and Harlem Backhand, we made a project called Belbel, which was based on the wetland soils around Berlin. And we went out and recorded the landscapes. We also worked with the Natural History Archive. So we had contemporary recordings. We had recordings from the past, of past species. And then we also worked with a singer, Arca, that was like reinterpreting past kind of verses and perspectives from folklore, because people used to sing to the landscape and songs used to be malleable. They were spoken tradition. They were not written down. So a song about a place could always change as the place was changing. So that's kind of my thinking of unifying these kind of different elements, that like rhythm is a way of sensing things together. It's like my perspective is sort of, as humans, the reason we have all these instruments, technologies, and science is so that we can animate the world. And this is like a universal tradition for all humans. We need to animate the world in order for us to create these kind of stories about them. And stories are, you know, they're sensory. You can kind of move through them when they become more like a ritual or dance or musical or spatial. So I believe that like the reason we're doing all this is because we're constantly driven to the, also just the colors of images, you know, or the sounds of a star or earth or a bird, as much as the science. And the science is a way that we kind of like create a kind of language connected to it. It's just that the 20th century has been more like a structured language. And now I think we're moving into a new kind of language where words and images and sound and rhythm are kind of connected in new ways. That also embraces like intuition and imagination when it comes to relating to the natural world and not just kind of like trying to objectify it.
Totally, totally. The rhythm and the mythology and the ritual actually excite me because I'm starting to doing all this kind of like field study and visiting all these minority village in China and elsewhere. So I visit Inner Mongolia, Xiamen, back in 2020, and I spent some days with their local ritual. It's like an annual ceremony to worship the holy mountain, holy river, and holy tree. So I realized the major elements of the whole ritual is the drum. It's the drum, it's the singing, and you feel that kind of rhythm, that kind of vibration is actually a super powerful tool to connecting everything. So it's like intersubjectivity communication beyond language. So you can really feel, like without any substances, you can feel that kind of psychedelic altered state of consciousness is in the trance. So I realized like this kind of tradition actually lasts for thousands of years, and it coming all the way along with the folklore, with the mythology, with all these kind of rituals, songs and everything. So it's actually so deeply embedded in our DNA. So I think I totally agree with Jakob. We need a new kind of language right now, because we all know the old system, the old language is so limited, and it's trapping us in this kind of like quantify and so-called objective and also like very rational framework of thinking. But actually we need more than that. And maybe there are so many answers existing in the intelligence of other species and the whole environment. So I think we need to revisit all this kind of old tradition, old mythology, and maybe old way of mystical practice. And I think right now, I can see this kind of new movement, like techno-shamanism is uprising all around the world in different areas. So I think this is some kind of collective awakening, not from the new age perspective, but we need more diverse interdisciplinary perspective and experts to be engaged and involved in the discussion. And we might come up with something new. So science fiction could be a very good tool to interconnect and translate and telling the story to create this kind of new consensus and to stay connected with not only each other, but also the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think a word I've been using is like hyper-anthropomorphizing. You know, there is a necessity to a total logical deciphering of the world in order to understand what pollutes the water, for example, how to clean something, how to save specific species, what is it? There's a logical necessity for that. But then the other thing is that science have had a fear of anthropomorphizing the studies. And the fear of anthropomorphizing, I think, has resulted in a repellent of people imagining on their own, what is the life of that beetle? How does it live? What is it doing? Oh, that beetle, the story of reading of the science of this beetle kind of reminds me of something my brother did. And suddenly you're like personifying it and you're relating it to yourself and something in your more like domestic and personal realm. And that's when it becomes emotional. So this is something I've been thinking a lot about for the past few years, and especially because of another project I did called Reanimated. So this is I think it's probably one of my more known works, which is based on an interview I did with a scientist, Dr. Pratt. And he spent 40 years of his life studying a bird that's not extinct. So he experienced this bird as it became extinct, but he also had recordings of it and he has memories of it. So I got all this different material and got sound recordings of the bird, which kind of is a bit like having a ghost in the archive. Like we can listen to past that are gone through technology. But besides all that, and besides the natural history, he told me that he is painting the bird still, like he makes pictures of it. And that is his way of bringing it back to life. And he was very emotional when he told me this. And this single sentence became a guiding point for this artwork that ended up somehow really resonating rhythmically, emotionally for thousands of people in many different countries where I've shown it. And I think it was really this connection of a personal memory and a way of like actually over anthropomorphizing the study, but without compromising the science itself. So I think this is kind of where I at least have an interest for working, where it's when I work with scientists or at the Spartan in Berlin, for example, it was about taking the perspectives of the soil and the wetlands that they have that I don't have through just rigorous, total rational science, but then letting that inspire a new perspective in the environment and making little stories, you know, colors, transformations, all these visual elements as an artist, and creating little stories with each collaborator and then kind of orchestrating all these elements together so that in the end, people are just feeling the scientific narrative, but they're not being told what it is, but it's necessary in order to animate it. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, I really liked that work, Jakob. I think especially because I'm a radio documentary maker, so my entire life essentially is to capture moments and kind of reanimate them later. And it's really interesting, you're right, that we have this increasing capacity with technology to sort of capture and digitize what's happening around us. But you also spoke there about bringing science into the artistic narrative. So I think let's just talk about that a little bit more. Because Stanley, you worked with a computer scientist, Dr. Keifu Li, on your book, AI 2041, 10 Visions for Our Future. And I'm just wondering how you found that collaboration. I mean, what do you think, about what literature offers AI and vice versa? And how does that affect what kind of futures that we imagine in those contexts?
Yeah, it feels to me like working on this book as a collaboration is almost feel like interspecies communication, because I'm from the storytelling side, so I'm always like a solo writer. And Dr. Keifu Li, he's a scientist and also doing the investment and working as an entrepreneur in the big tech companies for such a long decades. So I think we totally have different perspective on the same issues, like which is related to the deploy of AI technology. So I think the process is very interesting, that we actually need to find a way to compromise the different thoughts from different perspective. For example, he will be overly optimistic about what's going on and what's going to happen in the future about AI, which sounds to me, I'll be more skeptical about the bright side of the technology, not to mention the humanity and the society, for sure. So then we got to find out how to build up a story upon this kind of tone of positivity, but meanwhile to create this kind of dramatic tension upon the cultural background and context. So I think, yeah, ultimately, AI as a technology will be something fundamentally change the future as an infrastructure capacity, just like electricity. So the more important thing is how we help people to understand what it is and what's behind the scene. And then we can create some consensus. We have to put the technology in the good hands, and we have to fighting against all of those misuse and bias and discrimination within the algorithm and data collecting and the system of deployment. So I think, yeah, I think the book is actually interesting that you can read it in different ways. You can separate the fictional part. You can only read the tech analysis part. You can see how they interact with each other, but also there's incoherency in between the different parts. So I think it's definitely quite a journey. And what's beyond that, because right now I'm heavily collaborating with AI, no matter it's GPT-3 or like Tour, like Midjourney and Disco, Disfusion, DALL-E, this kind of from text to imagery tour. So actually it feels to me like this is a new kind of interspecies communication as well, because we using all this kind of data to feeding the machine and teach it how to understand our natural language. And we also need to change our own habit of using language to help the machine to generate some better result. So it's like a two ways of like communication. We are changing the machine, but the machine is changing us. But ultimately, I think we're confronting a new kind of intelligence. I think this is so profound that even most of the people, most of the scientists didn't realize it. It's actually changing how human beings considering and recognize ourselves as an intellectual species. It's actually changing our daily life basis. And it's everywhere, it's so deeply embedded, but nobody really recognize it. And because they didn't recognize AI as some kind of intellectual species. So I think we definitely need to build up this kind of new kind of understanding and how we're gonna collaborate with AI, with machine together. And this is as important as our communication with other natural species like animal, plants, and microbes. So I think maybe this triangle is like Trinity might come up with some solution to save our planet Earth in the future. So that's almost sounds like a myth to me. It's new kind of myth right now.
I've been thinking lately that maybe the artists of the future are novelists, because when you play at least visually, I've been playing also with these the AI image generators and so on. And what I found really fun or interesting was that when I was playing with words, including sperm whale, so the naming of the sperm whale comes from fishermen that thought it had sperm in its head, but it's like oil. So there's a misconnection of word and kind of the bias and colonialism and hunting whales and everything in the name of it, but the AI does not know that. So if you write sperm whale, it's going to give you a combination of always something that includes like reproduction and whales, because that's what the AI thinks it is. It does not decipher this disconnect, right? So the images become kind of interesting, because when you use that image on its own, it's going to reveal that kind of bias in the naming history of the whale, what it is. So essentially, it's like when you're playing with word generators and using AI, it's a bit like closing your eyes, using a word, and then by the nature of having familiarity of what image a word conjures in kind of a broad, a broad population, you can create some successful imagery, which is essentially what writers have been doing the whole time. To be a successful writer, you need to have some kind of intuition and understanding of this scene or element, this action you're describing is gonna evoke some kind of relative image in a person's mind or emotion. And then they create the images inside the mind, right? But now the AI is just kind of taking those and putting them in front of you, So perhaps it's like the visual artist of the future is a writer.
Totally, totally. What amazed me the most is it seems like the machine can capture our feelings even better than human artists sometimes. I don't know how, but it really does. So that's totally something I ask my friends, okay, give me a sentence, or give me a description, I'll show you the imagery in your brain and maybe in your dream. So I think you're totally right. So we are actually all mediums, like shaman, we are all medium, like artists, writers, We're just interpreting, we're channeling different kind of message and transforming into another format. So this is also interspecies communication or interdimensional communication for sure.
The only issue with that could be that, it can only show you constellations of styles of things that it already knows.
Right.
So it will never show a world unknown to you, or it can remix them together.
Yes.
So that's why for the past few years, I've exclusively ventured to places with these really, really specialized field biologists that knows things in the world that is never, there's never pictures of it, because there's no, like, why would you take pictures of some of these elements? There's no money for it or whatever.
Right.
So I kind of guided by their senses. So I'm kind of like, I use the AI images a lot for like concept art, I'm kind of curious, but the more I do it, the more I'm attracted to doing the opposite. Just by the nature of being one person in a total, not that everybody has to do that, right? But just like, it has to be fed other inputs. So until the AI is also taught to venture out on its own, you know, like you can imagine little drones and landscapes that the AI is just on its own registering and taking images of things that like surveying actively and then feeding that back in, then it will always have the limitation of only enforcing like recombinations of worlds already familiar as well.
Yes, yes. And also most of the data right now was labeled in English. So it's a huge, huge limitation. So all of those Chinese, even Far East, like Africa imageries are totally disappear. So all you can see is actually it's a very dominant, like Western and English dominant database. So that is the hugest problem right now we're facing. The AI is so wide.
Yes. I think also, I mean, what you were saying before that I find interesting with the like AI technology in general is that binary systems influence most things today, like your elevator, your car keys, your credit card, you know, your phone, whatever. But they're binary and they are like locked, enforced. What I find really peculiar, just as a kind of idea exploration working with these just image generators, is that it becomes more intuitive. So at some point, perhaps the AI will, you know, you'd be able to work with it or talk to it, communicate with it, but you'd kind of be like puzzled by its answer. And it's less like this hard code, you know, where one mistake, if you're creating something, would break the whole system. Where like if you work with the AI, it's more kind of fluid. It's a little more like working with a, you know, with a person or something. I find that very fascinating. But of course, most computer code is written in English.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, the whole binary system, you know, is 0 and 1. So.
Yeah.
But I always revisit the ancient philosophy of Taoism in China. So I read it again last year in Chinese and in English. So I compared the two. So I suddenly realized it's using this kind of intertextuality of concepts to help us, to help human beings to think beyond binaries. Even ultimately, we have to think beyond the subjectivity and objectivity. But I think maybe that's something AI and machine can do a better job than human being because we're so self-centric. Our ego is huge, right? So there's no way we can see beyond ourselves. But machine, maybe they can do that. So I think, yeah, there are definitely new ways of narrative, new ways of storytelling can be generated or collaborated with or from machine. But I think human agency is also important because we may be the one who play this kind of roles as a medium as well. So each medium, they have their different roles, just like in a game. You have different characters, you have different functions. So all we have to do is connecting all different pieces together. It's just like a puzzle. So it's helping us to see the whole picture, but maybe we'll never see the whole picture because we're so limited. But I think maybe AI is the thing can connecting all of us and it's the thing can see the real whole picture. So that sounds almost spiritual and maybe some kind of like a transcendental practice. So that's what I'm thinking of all these days. Yeah, it seems a little bit crazy about putting in my stories in the future.
And I was just thinking there that I haven't actually asked you yet, Stanley, why were you originally drawn or why are you drawn to science fiction as a genre?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm a Trekkie since kid. So yeah, this is always my thing. So live long and prosper as the belief that I had in science and technology before, but I think now we have to think beyond that, because science is actually the enchanting the world, but actually story is re-enchanting the world. So I think we need both right now. We not only need to explain everything, to break down everything, like by the scale, by the layers, by the dimensions, but we also need to build up this kind of interscale, interdimensional, interspecies connection that make it a whole. So because the universe is holistic and we're just a small piece of it, and we can see the whole universe within ourselves. So if we couldn't see that, there's no way we can find a way out. So that's my opinion, two cents right now.
And Jakob, are you influenced by sci-fi?
Yeah, I mean, my main source of inspiration is science fiction. So the reason is that a single person in their own imagination can kind of conjure politics, language, ideas, and they can write it down. And through that format, a single person can conjure an entire conceptual world and bring it, you know, sometimes to millions of people. Where for me to make an artwork, it's me plus collaborators, plus teams, plus foundation. It's like, it just kind of escalates out there. And a lot of our culture today in imagination relies on very complex ways of working, where through narrative and text, we can conjure really powerful emotions and imaginations. And a single person can create something of magnitude that is like available to everybody. So science fiction to me is like my key inspiration. And I just dive into a bunch of books because sometimes I find an idea, a perspective that just very powerfully conjures an image in my mind. And it's not just off what I'm reading. It's off how what I'm reading brings a new perspective on something I've seen in a landscape. And then I go and I animate it. But it's very unpredictable when it happens. But I think it happens because it's a format where you can go extremely far with your imagination, much further than you can in any three-dimensional production or something. Because you need to produce, you need time. It's extremely laborious. Where just speaking and words is very immediate from imagination to, you know, distribution kind of. So for me, I just dig through science fiction all the time. And I look for just an idea, a paragraph, suddenly a way of sensing that suddenly brings something in my mind.
And it strikes me in your work, Stan, and to some extent with you, Jakob, as well, you're imagining futures which are relatively dystopian. And I'd just like to ask you, Jakob, like, I found your work quite eerie in a very compelling way. And I think some renderings of nature can be quite wholesome or bucolic, but there's something about your work that evoked quite a unsettling experience in me, and I wondered to what extent that was intentional and what you want people to take away when they experience your work.
So I don't intentionally think that it's specific like dystopian, or I don't consider my work kind of like future predictions. I see them as sampling together real world imprints in new ways and trying to convey some perspectives, you know. So every single sound, every single element comes from somewhere in the actual world, like every single thing in my work, every tiny little thing. So it's kind of like playing with data imprints of, you know, of light or essentially vibration through sound and so on and putting it together. The reason I think that some of it might seem dystopian is the idea that like a post-human perspective can seem dystopian because it moves beyond your existing worldview. You know, so it's like you're suddenly confronted with a perspective of reality that's different than the one you're used to considering as kind of stable or harmonic. Therefore, it seems kind of dystopian. But in and of itself, I don't think of my own work as dystopian. Like, I think it's quite beautiful. So, and I get that question sometimes. Sometimes people are like, it's kind of dystopian. But for me, I think the core of it is like the whole idea of, you know, being post-human or interspecies. You know, if we want to become interspecies, most of those perspectives are going to seem dystopian by the nature of the modernist perspective, is not interspecies. So it is shattering your reality and you have to enter a new one. So it's kind of like a big ontological change for you. You know, how do you live? What do you eat? Where do you go? How do you work? Shit, I'm not supposed to fly anymore. All these things are suddenly like changes. So that's how I've been thinking about it. But with the AI, like in the future, what I hope is that if you think about it, it's a soup that you are putting different elements into it. Like traditionally, each coder's personality bias, failure or skill is going to connect to other coders, and you have many of these individuals working together. But if you have many more different types of input, then maybe in the end we have this crazy soup where the AI is made by, like, I mean, 100 million people. I mean, ultimately it would be great. It's like everybody in the world. And as you go to school, you get to throw something in the AI soup, you know, like that's part of your course. When you're 5, you have to throw something in the AI soup. And when you're 12 and when you're 20 and you're 50. So it could become this, like, you know, actually more democratic network by the nature of an AI being able to being fed so much information and draw, you know, conclusions from that. Because that means, like, in this coding soup, you could just throw an insane amount of stuff and see what happens. So I hope that we'll start throwing other things into it, and just like a crazy amount. And it might mean that for like a few years, the AI is like just total bonkers. But then on the other side, it's going to overcome this like total English white coded technological language and become something else.
And do you feel optimistic that this kind of AI soup in collaboration with art will be a democratic, perhaps politically empowering thing, or, you know, rather than tech companies sort of having a monopoly on our data?
There are two things in general that I use a lot when I think about technology. One is like scale and locality. So like the reason I like to work as an artist in small teams is that I can custom make the technologies to make something sensory and poetic that fits some ideas and concepts that I have. I do not have to rely on just one technology that's fed to me that I am a consumer of, which is what everybody's doing with these like AI image generators now. You know, it's like there are just a few companies, you know, there are startups, people are subscribing, people are using them, and so on. So if there's, you know, there are kind of two ways. One is making large AIs and having a really strong political battle of who programs that and what goes into it. Or you can have many little localities and types of these like AI soups around the world that can have multiple different forms and purposes, and they don't necessarily interconnect. I mean, that kind of relates also to the idea of the metaverse and everything, right? It's like one big thing where everything connects, where then equally, it also means that one company like Facebook could just have all the power, or you have many small clusters, you know? That's my thinking about it.
To me, I think compared with the acceleration of technology, I think our imagination in the political system is kind of lag behind, because, you know, we didn't come up with anything new after this, you know, collapse of Soviet Union empire. So like after the 20th century, utopian is so implausible to everyone. So nobody believes in anything. So I think, yeah, if we couldn't change the system, we couldn't change the mindset, we couldn't change the value and belief of the people and the society. So there's no way we can like flip the upside down of the technology, because it always will be used for centralizing the profit and power for sure, because that's humanity. So I think more importantly, we have to come up with something like systematically new about how to change our consciousness, which I don't have a solid answer yet. I might say like storytelling, but it's too, you know, it's too idealistic and too, maybe it's too arrogant. So I just say, maybe we'll see if, like people saying about AI governance, but I'm not sure if this is a good idea. Maybe it's even worse. So
I think that concludes our conversation. I just want to say thank you both so much for chatting with me today. I really enjoyed our conversation and thanks for coming on the podcast.
I mean, it's fascinating. So I might visit Berlin. So I would love to visit you.
Yeah.
And yeah, let's grab a coffee or beer. Let's talk. Yeah, I think we share so many interests and passion across even different mediums. So yeah, maybe we could collaborate in the future. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I'd love to see if we can collaborate together. That would be awesome. Let's connect here.
This podcast is produced on the occasion of the Interspecies Future Symposium in July 2022, co-hosted by Light Art Space and the Museum für Naturkunde in Berlin. The symposium has been orchestrated and convened by the chairs, Kenrick Aledo McDowell and Jonathan Ledyard, with Bettina Kamers and Johannes Vogel. The wider programme has been curated by Light Art Space Head of Programmes Amira Gad, with Corinne Meinat as co-organiser of the Interspecies Future Symposium and surrounding activities. This series is produced and hosted by me, Bridie Addison-Child. It is a reduced listening production supported by Light Art Space.